Good morning and welcome to the initial meeting of the Means Committee for February 10th. Nice to see everyone here. It's a good thing. We're going to start out this morning with introductions. And I will start with Representative Agbaje and make our way around all the way to Novotny.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Esther Agbaje. I'm a third-term DFL member, represent a district that covers North Minneapolis and downtown Minneapolis. And this is my second time on Waze. Thank you.
Representative Carly Katiza-Watoon. I represent 49B, which is most of the city of Eden Prairie. I'm in my fourth term and serving as a DFL lead on the Children and Families Committee.
Rep. Aaron Cagle. I represent District 39A, which is Fridley Hilltop, Columbia Heights, Spring Lake Park. First time on Waze.
Representative Samantha Vang, I represent Brooklyn Center and Brooklyn Park, and also first time in Waze.
Representative Robert Bierman, Apple Valley, first time on Waze, lead on the health, finance, and policy.
Representative Joaquim, Cheryl Joaquim, second time, I believe, on Ways and Means, second session, and I am the lead on education finance.
Representative Dave Pinto from the southwest part of St. Paul. I am the DFL lead for Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development with Chair Baker, and also the DFL lead for the Fraud Prevention and Agency Oversight Committee with Chair Robbins. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Kelly Moeller, and I represent District 40A, Northern Ramsey County Suburbs. I'm the DFL lead on the Public Safety Committee, and this is my second time on Waze.
Aisha Gomez, I represent District 62A, which is the south side of Minneapolis, my second term on Waze. I am the DFL lead on the Tax Committee.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Representative Patty Akam. I represent House District 45B, which is parts of Minnetonka, all of Wayzata, Deep Haven, Shorewood, or excuse me, a little bit of Shorewood and all of Woodland. I am the lead on the Energy Committee and my second time.
Good morning. I'm State Representative Jenny Cleborn. I represent 42B, which is the eastern part of Plymouth and all of Medicine Lake. I serve as the DFL lead on state government, finance, and policy, and this is my second term on Waze.
Good morning. My name is Zach Stevenson. I represent the Halloween capital of the world, Anoka, Minnesota, as well as my hometown of Coon Rapids, Minnesota, and I am the DFL lead on this committee, but I'm also the ex officio member of the DFL, so I will not be voting for 5 weeks.
We'll do all members first, but I'm going to go back and pick up Representative Noor.
Good morning. State Representative Mahmoud Noor. I represent District 60B, that is in Minneapolis, and I'm the lead in Human Services Policy and Finance.
I'm State Representative Paul Torkelson in my ninth term in the Minnesota House. I have no idea how many times I've been on Ways and Means, but some. And it's a pleasure to be here. I represent District 15B in southwestern Minnesota, all of Brown County, all of Redwood County, and three townships in Blue Earth County.
Oh, Representative Kristen Robbins, I represent District 37A, which is western Maple Grove and all of Corcoran, Medina, Greenfield, Independence, Loretto, and Maple Plain. Looking forward to being on this committee with all of you.
Josh Heinzman, I have the Brainerd Lakes area, the chair of the Environment Committee. This is my sixth term, second time on Ways and Means.
Morning, everybody. Spencer Igo, House District 7A, so that's about half of Minnesota's Iron Range. I'm also the chair of Housing, and this is my first time on Ways.
Representative Peggy Scott, I represent northern Anoka County, parts of Andover, parts of Ham Lake, parts of Oak Grove, all of East Bethel, and two townships, one of which is in Isandy County. And I think I've been on here four terms.
I'm Representative Nolan West. I represent Blaine, Ham Lake, and Columbus in the Minnesota State House. I am chair of the Children and Families Committee, and I will spend my time here learning what the back of your heads look like.
Joe Schumacher, representing southwestern Minnesota, and on this committee, because the Services Committee is one that just keeps giving.
I'm Representative Jim Nash. I am in my sixth term. I am the chair of State Government Finance, and I think this is the fourth time I've been on this committee. I think it's so much fun. I just keep signing up to do more. But thanks.
Representative Marion Rarick, formerly O'Neill. It's not O'Neill anymore because I married State Senator Jason Rarick. It's a crazy world. I represent 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake, out in Wright County, and I am the chair of the Higher Ed Committee, and I honestly don't know how long I've been on this committee either, but it is my sixth term.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Members, Dave Baker, I represent most of Candiota County, so straight west of here. I'm a small business guy. I have served on Ways a few years ago. It's been a break here, so I'm looking forward to getting back on Ways, and I currently serve as chair of the Workforce Labor Committee alongside Representative Pinto.
Paul Navani, public safety chair from 30B, which is Elk River, Otsego, Nowthen, and Oak Grove.
Thank you. Members, we'll continue with non-member introductions, and Matt, you're next in line.
Matt Eichinger, House GOP Research for Ways and Means and Health.
Hi, everyone. My name is Emily Adrians, and I'm the Chief Fiscal Analyst.
I'm Allie Spellman. I'm the CLA for Ways and Means.
Hi, Harry Kennedy. I'm the Committee Administrator and look forward to working with you all.
Good morning, members. I'm Colby Sullivan with the Nonpartisan House Research Department. I've staffed this committee since 2013, and I also, for the first time this year, staffed the State Government Finance and Policy Committee.
Hey, everyone. I'm Sean Herring. I'm the DFLCA for the committee, and this is my first time on Ways and Means.
We also have with us this morning Dave Sullivan, DFL staffer, in the background there. I think that's all of the staff. What am I missing?
Apologies, everybody. I'm Faith Prevett. I'm the DFL CLA for Ways. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a couple of pages. If they would please stand. We have Kristen Monkey and Connor Beckel. Welcome to committee. I asked them to give a speech, but they declined. I believe we've covered the introductions. The lead, Stevenson, asked for 30 seconds. I have my timer starting now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you giving me this opportunity to speak. And I do look forward to working with you throughout this session. It appears, though, that today won't be in that spirit of collaboration. You know, instead, I have to express our side's disappointment that instead of starting with sort of a nonpartisan view of the state's budget, or a nonpartisan view of the November forecast, we're starting out with a presentation from a group that is very much aligned with the Republican Party. And just wanted to express that disappointment, hope that we can work more collaboratively going forward, but I don't think that will be today.
Well, thank you, Representative Stevenson, for your remarks. I would just note that these voices have been absent from the committee room for many years, and giving them a chance to see the light of day is, I think, certainly appropriate. We have a handshake agreement to operate in a bipartisan fashion, and I do intend to work with you. This is no personal attack, but it is just an opportunity to hear perhaps a different perspective than has been heard at this Capitol for a long time, especially the last 2 years. With that, we're going to go into the presentation. Please introduce yourselves for the record and go ahead. By the way, we're going to hold questions until the presentation is over, so note your questions, and we'll do them at the end of the presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So my name is Mathenjo Mali. I'm here with my colleague, John Phelan. We are economists at Center of the American Experiment. For those of you who are not familiar, American Experiment is a public policy think tank. We do research on wide-ranging issues from education, public safety, energy and environment, and as we're here to discuss with you today, taxes and spending. As residents of this state, we are deeply invested in the success of Minnesota, and we believe that smart budgeting policies are a key part of that. So we understand the challenges that come with balancing limited resources among competing unlimited needs. So we thank you for having us today, and we hope that our presentation today will help provide some clarity as you navigate the issue that we have before us, which is the looming budget deficit in the 2020-2029 biennium. With that, I will start the presentation here with the slide. We are all aware of the budget deficit, which is the $5.14 billion we're expecting in the 2020-29 biennium. But I would like to draw your attention to, I think, what is a bigger issue that deserves even more attention. And this is the fact that beginning in 2024, in the entire forecast period to 2029, we will be operating with a structural imbalance in every fiscal year in that period. So in every year, we are collecting less revenue than we are spending. So if you're looking at the current biennium that we're in, we are spending about $71 billion, but we are collecting $61 billion, leaving an imbalance of about $9 billion. And then we go into the next biennium, which ends with a surplus, a $600 million surplus. But again, we have a structural imbalance of over $3 billion, which grows in the next biennium. So what this tells us is that this is a structural problem. It's the underlying ability of Minnesota's tax system to support the state government has been deeply undermined. And it is very concerning, especially now, because we are not in a recession. Our tax revenues are going up, but still we are spending more than we are collecting, which could continue to be an issue going forward. And then looking at how this came up or how we've been spending over the years, I have another chart here showing general fund spending going back to 1990. So all of these numbers are adjusted for inflation. So as you can see, we've been on an upward trend for except for a few instances like in 2010 and 2022. But the biggest jump in spending that we had was between 2023 and 2024. So we saw the annual general fund budget go from $28 billion to $35 billion. So that is a 26% hike in spending in a single year. And of course, some of that was one-time money. So there's a little bit of a dip going into 2026. But again, we start that climb up again in 2026, going all the way to 2029. So spending beginning in 2026, 7 to 29, will still be higher than at any period before the 2024 fiscal year. And then, of course, we control for population. We understand that, you know, we usually have more people every year in Minnesota most of the time than the previous year, so it matters that we control for population growth. When we do that, the trend is still the same. So in inflation-adjusted per capita numbers, we went from spending $4,800 in 2023 to spending over $6,000 per person in 2024. So now here again, there is a little dip going into 2026, but we start that climb again going to 2029. So for every single year between 2026 to 2029, per capita inflation-adjusted spending is still going to be higher in Minnesota at any year prior to 2024. Here's just another chart to illustrate the change that happened to the budget in the 2023 session. So we are all aware every February, Minnesota Management and Budget gives us estimates of what we need to spend in order to maintain the current level of services in Minnesota. So in the 2023 forecast, MMB estimated that in the current biennium, we would need to spend $55 billion to maintain the same level of services that we had in the 2022-2023 biennium. But then, as you can see now from the November 2024 forecast, that baseline is up by $15 billion. And then we go into the next biennium again. The original February 2023 forecast had a budget of about $59 billion, but again, in the November 2024 forecast, that is up by nearly $8 billion, which again gives us the higher baseline in the 2028-2029 biennium. Another chart that illustrates the flip that happened in that session, I have two charts here just showing the differences between current revenues and spending. So this is just revenues collected in each biennium. It does not account for any balances being brought forward into that session because to a lot of researchers, that is the best way to gauge the health of the tax system to support the state budget. So as you can see in the 2023 February forecast, the spending line, which is the red line, was consistently below the tax revenue line. So in each of those bienniums in the 2022-23 biennium, we were ending with a $9 billion structural surplus. And then we were going to have at least $10 billion between 2024 and 2027. So if we had stuck to this original trend line, we would likely be talking about over $20 billion surplus right now. But the other chart is now where we are at. And you, as you can see, those lines are flipped. So the spending line, which is the red line, is consistently above the collected revenues line, again showing that significant change that happened in 2023. So for us to address this issue, of course, we have to know where a lot of this spending changes, spending growth is coming from. So here's another chart just showing the four biggest spending categories in the budget. So A12 education is the biggest category by far, and it is followed by health and human services. Tax and credits and higher education are a very far third and fourth position. As you can see here, this is general fund growth since 1990, that A12 education and health and human services are the two fastest growing categories in the budget, but even more so for HHS, because as you can see here from this chart, by 2029, according to the forecast, HHS spending will be nearly four times what it was in 1990. E12 education has grown, of course, but its growth is flattening a little bit in the 2025 to 29 biennium. So really, HHS is the biggest growing category in the state budget, and that is where we would need to look for any potential savings in the budget. Just to illustrate here why these two are the places where we need to look at the most, I have another chart that shows the share of spending by category. So as you can see here, E12 education has been consistently a big share of the budget. It used to be about 32% of the budget in 1990. That share has grown a little bit to around 37%, 34%, and then 42% of the budget. By 2029, it's going to be about 38%. But then when you look at health and human services, it used to be a little further behind E12 education. So in 1990, it was about 21% of the budget. But then you're looking at 2019, it is going to exceed E12 education and become the biggest spending category in the budget in that year. And actually, when we include the discretionary inflation part of HHS, that change starts earlier in 2028. So this chart takes that out. So this just looks at spending without the inflation part of the budget. So as you can see, the other spending categories have mostly actually shrunk as part of the budget. So just giving an example here, higher education used to be about 15% in 1990, but by 2029, it's going to be about 5%. So not only are HHS and E12 education growing faster than all of the other spending categories, but they are taking also a bigger and growing share of the budget, which essentially means that all of these other services are fighting for a smaller and shrinking share of the state budget, which again brings the risk of neglect for other essential services such as public infrastructure and public safety. So just to give a little bit more detail of where the growth is coming from in each of these categories, I have per biennium growth in E12 education here in billion dollars. So the number in the 2026-27 biennium is how much spending is growing compared to the current biennium that we're in. So I have current revenues in the first line just to show that that is growing as well. So we do not have a revenue issue. But again, as revenues are growing, so we have spending growing as well. So eTorv Education is growing in both of the next bienniums, but the bigger growth is happening in the 2028-29 biennium at $1.6 billion. And then when we split eTorv Education to see where a lot of that growth is happening, we see general education and special education making up the biggest changes. But special education is where a lot of that growth is coming from. More than at least half of that growth is happening. And then when we split health and human services in the next slide, we see that in 2026-27, health and human services is actually growing by more than the growth in collected tax revenues. So we are going to see HHS grow by $2.8 billion in the next biennium, whereby revenues are only up by $2.4 billion. In the 2028-29 biennium, of course, it's slightly lower than revenues, but still 80% of our revenue growth in that biennium is going to HHS. We split HHS and we look at DHS. We see the same thing, too. There's growth in the 2028-29 biennium. There's a slight decline in the next biennium, but a big part of that is because we're taking out the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, which is about a little over $20 billion that is not accounted on here. And then we have the direct care and treatment as well, which are not part of this. But again, we go a little bit more into detail with DHS. We look at the Medicare program, which is the biggest program in DHS. We see that it is growing again by more than tax revenues are growing. So in the 2026-27 biennium, MA is growing by over $3 billion, which is again over 100% of revenues. And then we go into more detail as well with MA. We see that a lot of the growth is happening in long-term care waivers, and this is the issue that the Minnesota Management and Budget actually did identify in the November 2024 forecast. Just to illustrate again the changes in health and human services, so this is a chart showing the budget trends between the 2023 February forecast and the most recent forecast. So as you can see from the blue line, HHS was supposed to grow from $15 billion to about $18 billion and then reach $20 billion in the next biennium. But due to a lot of changes, we are now going from $15 billion to $21 billion and then to $24 billion. Now, I'd like to acknowledge that some of this growth is some changes that have happened recently that are not directly related to policies, such as increases in enrollment as well as healthcare prices. But when we're looking at the Human Services Omnibus Bill and the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill is passed in the 2023 session, those added about over $4 billion in general fund to HHS. And then when we look in the November forecast, MMB did note that some of the current increases in HHS is directly related to those changes that happened in that session. So in addition to that $4 billion, there have been an addition, hundreds of millions, I think potentially $1 billion more that has been added to HHS indirectly because of those changes. So here's just another chart to illustrate that growth in spending in long-term care waivers. So this is total spending on medical assistant per enrollee by their eligibility category. So this includes money that is coming from the federal government as well, just to make that clear. So as we can see, the fastest growing spending category here is long-term care waivers, which allow the aged and disabled people with disabilities to access home and community-based care. So that is growing from about, compared to between 2019 and 2029, That is growing by 41% from about $63,000 to $89,000. And then the second fastest growing category is long-term care facilities, the line at the top. And then basic care for the elderly and disabled is growing a little bit as well, but it does not compare to the other two. As you can see, the line at the bottom, when we're looking at basic care for families with children, that line is mostly flat. So again, where a lot of growth is coming from is these two areas, which is long-term care services. And that is where we need to look to reform this. Now, I understand there's a lot of concern, and for a good reason, about reforming HHS spending, to be particular, DHS spending. But I would just like to share a couple of things about where Minnesota ranks compared to a lot of other states when it comes to welfare spending, but even more specifically, Medicaid spending. So looking at the data, Minnesota has always been a generous state. That has been true even if we go back to the days of welfare reform in the 1990s. We've always have high income eligibility limits for our programs. So we enroll more people than most other states. At the same time, too, we have higher than average spending levels per recipient across the board. Even if we're talking about Medicaid, cash assistance, or childcare, we do tend to invest more than most other states. We've also our spending has also grown faster, which means that we've been able to maintain our position at the top. So even if we're to go back to the years of, say, 2022, we would still remain one of the most, if not the most, generous state in this country because we've always kept up that commitment to care for our vulnerable people in this state. So here's a chart showing public welfare spending per person in poverty. Now, this is not a perfect measure in any way. We are not exactly writing a $40,000 check to every person, poor person in Minnesota. But it allows us to see how we compare to other states, how much we invest in our vulnerable people. So again, just to make this clear, this includes the federal spending, and it adds up spending on various programs, including Medicaid, childcare, cash assistance as well. So when we take all of that money, we divide it by the population in poverty in Minnesota. What we did find is that in 2022, we were the second highest spending state on that measure. So we were next only to Massachusetts. The median state spent about $23,000. So we were spending about over 70% more than the median state per person in poverty. And then in the next slide, I take that number all the way back to 2010. As you can see here, we've always spent more than the median state. In 2010, we actually spent more than double the median state. And because we've been growing since then, even though the median state has grown at a little bit of a higher rate, we've been able to keep up that distance between Minnesota and the rest of these states since then. Again, these numbers are adjusted for inflation, so everything is in 2022 dollars. Here's another chart just going into some specific programs, but even more specifically, the Medicaid program. So this is our biggest spending program in DHS, and this is also where the biggest growth is coming from as well. And this is also where we tend to invest the most money. So this chart here is showing total Medicaid spending per enrollee who gets into Medicaid through the age category. So these are people that are 65 and older. So as you can see, in 2022, we were second only to North Dakota on the amount that we're spending per person in this category. Again, this includes money coming from the federal government as well. The next chart is showing the people with disabilities. So we were number one in the country on this in this category. But what I would like to draw your attention to here is the gap between Minnesota and the next state, which is New York. So we spent about $15,000 more than the next highest spending state on Medicaid per person in this category. Again, this doesn't include all of the new money that we put in the 2023 session. This is just another chart showing all of the Medicaid categories. So Minnesota is in blue, and the median state is the one in red. And as you can see, for every single category in Medicaid, we are above the state median. So again, we've always been a generous state. We've kept up that investment to vulnerable people in Minnesota. There are a couple of concerning trends that are coming up that will continue to put some pressure on health and human services spending. So I'd just like to touch on that just to illustrate the need or the necessity for us to especially reform DHS spending. A couple of those things that state policy has no control over, but that are going to keep putting pressure on HHS spending are growing population. We have a federal debt issue that is, you know, keeps growing at the moment. And the other thing is rising healthcare prices. On the population issue, I think we are all aware, at least most of us are aware, that the developed world is facing declining birth rates. People are not having as many kids as they used to. With that, our population is aging. The median age in Minnesota, as well as the rest of the country, is going to go up. So I have a chart here showing a population pyramid from the Minnesota State Demographic Center. And what that shows you is that by about 2050, we are going to have more people over 65 than we would have children below 14. So what that essentially means is that we are going to need to spend more on public services for the elderly, such as Medicaid, for instance, long-term care services. But at the same time, it also means that our workforce will probably stagnate or decline, which means that the tax base is going to decline. We won't have as many people paying, contributing into these programs, making it even more essential that we make some changes before this issue gets worse. The other thing that is happening, of course, is the growing federal debt. Right now, total federal debt is at about 123% of GDP. Debt held by the public is also reaching 100% of GDP and is supposed to keep growing, as projection from the Congress on budget shows. Now, the federal government contributes about 50% of the money that we spend on health and human services. Now, with this growing debt, there's been a talk about potentially cutting some of that funding to the states. The Congressional Budget Office, for instance, has suggested capping Medicaid matching rates to the state. So if that were to happen, it means that we would potentially be looking at hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, just to maintain our Medicaid system at the way that it is right now. The other issue that is going on that is also important to take note of is rising healthcare prices. So when we compare all items to medical care tends to grow faster than our average prices. So this is cumulative CPI since about 2000. As you can see, medical prices have more than doubled in that 24-year period. Other prices have also grown, but there's about a 34 percentage point difference in those two. So what that means is, you know, as we grow, as we keep going, this high medical care CPI is going to put more pressure on our Medicaid system, again, on like basic care services and things like that, which again necessitates that we do something to reform our spending before those factors continue to put a stronger push on our budget. So at this point, I'm going to hand it over to my colleague, John, to continue the rest of this presentation.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello there, my name is John Phelan. I'm Martha's colleague, economist at the Center of the American Experiment. Thank you very much for having us here today. So we're going to talk a little bit about things that you should do, things that we shouldn't do. The first one is to go back to something that we talked about before. The short term, if we look at general fund spending per capita, which is what this chart shows you, you see that it's gone up massively, as we've talked about, in the last couple of years. And so when we look at this deficit that we're facing in the biennium of 2028 to 2029, we believe that that should be closed entirely with spending cuts, with no tax hikes. And we, furthermore, this shows that if you did that, if you did close that deficit entirely with spending cuts and with no tax hikes at all, you would still be spending in per capita, inflation-adjusted terms, more money per Minnesotan than in any year before 2024. And that just gives you some idea of what an explosion in government spending there has been in the last couple of years. This here is a chart showing you the long-term 2019 baseline adjusted for inflation and population growth. We should be looking at how to reform this. That's a kind of longer-term fix because this is not a problem that's going to go away over the next couple of cycles. Without some real reforms, which Martha has talked about, we are going to be coming back to this situation repeatedly as we move forward for the demographic pressures that we discussed. As I say, tax hikes are not an option in our opinion. The reasons for this are that Minnesota is already a high-tax state. This is a chart from the Tax Foundation. It shows you that Minnesota has the fifth highest top rate of income tax in the United States. We occasionally hear suggestions that this should be increased or that there should be a fifth, even higher tier on top of that. Those proposals should be disregarded completely. This shows you the sales tax. Minnesota has the 15th highest combined rate of state and local sales tax in the United States. Now, this is the rate. So this is the rate applied to things that we levy the sales tax on, of course. It doesn't include, it doesn't really count for the effect of the size of the base. Minnesota has a narrow sales tax base at the moment compared to a lot of states. There are proposals to expand that base, and I think those are a good idea. Believe me, contrary to some comments that you may have heard, we will support good ideas when we hear them. It's just we don't always hear good ideas that we can support. So broadening the sales tax base is a good idea, but it needs to be offset with a cut in the sales tax rate. And that's why the current proposal that's floating around does not get our backing, because the state, the cut in the sales tax rate is not enough to offset the increase in the sales tax base. And again, it's just another tax hike on ordinary, hard-pressed Minnesotans. The corporate income tax rate. We have the second highest rate of corporate income tax in the United States now. This is down from the top rate of corporate income tax a year or so ago. This is not because of anything we've done. It's just because other states, New Jersey in this case, have decided to hike their corporate income tax a bit higher. These are not states that we necessarily want to emulate, the likes of New Jersey, California, and Illinois, for reasons that we'll look at a little bit down the line. This shows you again, illustrates the point that we are a high tax state. This shows you state tax collections per capita in 2022. And you see there at $6,097, we are one of the top taxing states in America. This shows you the state local tax burden as a share of state income in 2022. And again, we are one of the highest in the US there. If you think back to the Minnesota miracle in the early 1970s, the idea was that we would trade lower local tax payments for higher income tax payments. But over the years, that's kind of been eroded, and you've just ended up with both. Both your income tax payments and your local property tax payments have gone up. High taxes have a negative impact on the economy. Now, we all like to follow the evidence and follow the science, of course. So what I've got here, and I don't intend to read these out, are some literature summaries of the academic work on the impact of state taxes on economic growth. So this is really just to kind of read these things into the record. These are from economists, William McBride. This is his 2012 summary. This is another summary from 2021. These are all on your handouts, of course. And this is from 2022. This is the most recent one. I will read this one out just because it's the recent one. Studies broadly conclude that tax changes generate significant behavioral responses from individuals. They also largely indicate that tax increases can generate increased revenue for government, but often at the expense of economic growth and mobility for taxpayers. Conversely, tax cuts tend to produce short-lived revenue decreases, while promoting long-term economic growth. Taxes, particularly on corporate and individual income, harm economic growth. And as we've seen, those are some of the areas where we have got some of the most harmfully high taxes. One avenue through which this works, through which these high taxes do depress economic growth, is their impact on mobility, where people live. This is a paper from a number of economists. I won't read all their names out, but I do feel, again, it's important to read this into the record, because when I have testified about this evidence before, I have been told it doesn't exist. So this is a quote from these economists. It says, there is growing evidence that taxes can affect the geographic location of people, both within and across countries. This migration channel creates another efficiency cost of taxation with which policymakers need to contend when setting tax policy. This paper, I would stress, was published in a peer-reviewed journal, and it is a literature summary. It's a literature review, so it summarizes the findings of all the papers that there are on this subject. This is the kicker, in my opinion. This body of work has shown that certain segments of the labor market, especially high-income workers and professions with little location-specific human capital, may be quite responsive to taxes in their location decisions. And we see that with Minnesota. For all the money that we spend and for all the good that we claim this is doing, people are skedaddling from the state at reasonably high rates. This here shows you the net gain or loss of the 2019 population per 100,000 of the residents that year. And you'll see down there the red bars, the dark red bar, Minnesota is one of the losers. The states which have gained, by contrast, include states like our neighbors in South Dakota. When I point out this evidence, and people sometimes say to me, you know, well, okay, we concede it exists, but a lot of that's driven by the weather. If you look at some of these states like Idaho and South Dakota, people certainly aren't moving there for the weather. If they are, they're in for a shock. One thing I would say about this as well is that there is even evidence that the state's high taxes have a negative impact on the performance of the state's sports teams, a subject which I'm sure is close to every Minnesotan's heart. This here shows you GDP growth. This, of course, is where the rubber meets the road, as they say. And so this shows you the impacts of these high taxes on economic growth. This shows you economic growth from 1998. It's indexed, so that's the base year, that's 100. And you'll see that up until about, you know, we're looking at 2017 here, we were kind of doing okay, and we kind of outstripped the United States growth over that period. And since then, we have not. Since then, we have lagged the national growth rate. Indeed, as this chart shows you here, Minnesota has lagged the national growth rate in GDP per capita in every single year since 2014. What this chart shows you is that before that year, we broke even, roughly, with the national growth rate. So in the years where the bar is blue, that's where Minnesota's GDP per capita grew faster than the United States. And in the year, and bars where it's red, those are the years where it grew more slowly. And so you see, again, up to about 2014, we kind of broke even, and that's what this chart here kind of shows you. You see, again, though, since 2014, as I say, GDP per capita in Minnesota has grown more slowly than the United States in every single year. The effect of that is this. Minnesota's premium in per capita GDP over the United States in 2017 dollars, this is adjusted for inflation, Minnesota always used to be able to claim a premium for living in the state. GDP per capita was higher than it was for the United States generally. And you can see that this premium goes back a long way, and you can see that it was generally quite high. So as late as recently as 2015, we're looking at $4,669 per Minnesotan. Times that by four for a family of four, and you're looking at some serious money. So, you know, when you were sitting at your home feeling cold in the winter, you could at least feel good about that. You see that since 2014, that number has gone down quite spectacularly, in fact, and it's gone down and down and down again, as I say, because our growth rate has lagged that of the United States every single year. And so that premium in 2023 was down to just $435 per Minnesotan. And if you look at the quarterly data, that premium disappeared completely in 2024. In terms of per capita GDP, Minnesota is now a below average state, and it has been on that path since 2014. When we talk about things that we should do going forwards, one idea I have is that we should enact a taxpayer's bill of rights, a TABOR. This would tie the hands of spendthrift politicians by limiting the growth of state government spending. Essentially what it says is that the state government spending cannot grow faster than X. Now, what could X be? X could either be the growth rate of the population plus the growth rate of inflation. This is reasonably restrictive. I can talk to you a little bit more if you're more interested about things called Balmol's cost disease, which of course would put you in a sticky situation there. An alternative is the growth rate of state GDP, and that way you would kind of limit the amount of state income that the state government is gobbling up. Another one is to have the average annual wage in the state, so that the state government gets no more money to spend in rate terms than the average person who lives there. The growth rate of personal income, that's another possibility. The important thing, I think, to note, and it's the same with kind of general fiscal rules or monetary policy rules even, what X is matters less than that X exists. This, I think, is obviously quite a big lift legislatively, but I do think it's worth considering. There are states that have it. People sometimes say to me, well, states like Colorado, they find ways around their table. I'm sure they do, because I don't doubt that politicians are going to be trying to get money out of their citizens forever. But I do think it's better to have an obstacle in the way and to make it a bit more difficult for them than to have no obstacle at all and give them a free run at your wallet. That brings my part of the presentation to an end. That brings the presentation to an end. And I would say thank you very much. And, yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you for your presentation. Before we go on to comments and questions, we do have some latecomers that were not here for the introductions. We'll accommodate them in the order of appearance, starting with Representative Swazinski.
Hi, Chris Swazinski, represent House District 15A.
Representative Kreisha.
Representative Kreisha, and I represent House District 10A, Little Falls area.
And finally, Representative Lilly.
Good morning, Leon Lilly, 44B.
Welcome to committee. Just to remind everyone, I have every intention of starting committee on time every time, and try to make every effort to be here in a timely fashion. That's appreciated. Before we go to questions, I would just like to thank the presenters for their presentation. And remind everyone in the room that this is not a caucus position. This is a presentation from an organization with some good basic information that we should all consider as we work our way through this budgeting process. I would also comment that all these numbers are statewide numbers. There's no regional accommodation for the impact of state policy on different regions of the state over time, which is something I'm very interested in, and I hope that we can take a look at as we move through the process. With that, we'll go to questions, and starting with Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the presenters today, thank you for the information that you presented. As I noted in my introductions, I live in the corner of the state. I physically live 12 miles from the South Dakota border and about 8 miles from the Iowa border. Iowa right now is trying to purchase us, and just this last year, my hometown was included in the Sioux Falls metropolitan area. So the border city dynamics and the drive out from my area of the state is real. There we see it all the time. And I run a small business, and so I try to collect sales taxes on behalf of the state and bring that back to the state. We do a lot more in sales tax than we do income tax during that time, and it gets harder because people are moving across the borders. We see that quite a lot. Just to offer that as kind of commentary before we begin, I had a couple of questions and points just to offer some context, and I just really want to understand if I'm understanding these rights within the context that I'm looking at the slide, specifically with slide 13, as that was the annual MA spending per enrollee by eligible category or eligibility category. And looking at some of those pieces there, the first kind of contextual piece that I thought it's when I look at this, I look at it like it's comparing the elderly and disabled basic care line that stays fairly steady and the family with children based care line that stays pretty steady, and then the long-term care waivers and long-term care facilities that show more growth, and that those should be compared. And if we can keep flatlined in one area, why can't we keep flatlined in the other area? And so the first point as part of context is I would just note that when it comes to long-term care facilities and some of the long-term care waivers, you're talking about 24/7 care, just global type of care, where some of the other pieces can be literally as small as 15 minutes a month, but that counts as the per capita piece versus someone who has 24/7 care, and that makes it hard to show this comparison if I'm understanding these numbers right. And I don't question the numbers because those, of course, come from the forecast, but I do wonder about the context piece. The second point I wanted to make about this slide here is looking at the time frame from 2019 to 2024, specifically with the long-term care facilities piece there. We got a presentation from the long-term care imperative a few weeks ago, and one of the slides in there talked about that 2019 to 2024 time frame, and they had a presentation on what they had presented on was CNA wages during that time, what the average was there, and the average for CNA wages went up by $1.75 during that same time frame here. And if we extrapolate that over 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you're looking at a $15,330 per person increase during that amount of time just for the base wages, just to pay for a CNA to be covering someone for 24 hours a day in a long-term care facility. At the same time, this report, your chart there, shows from 2019 to 2024 a $15,266 per capita increase in that. And so, Mr. Chair, I would argue that we're getting pretty good value if we can raise the wages for our CNA workers, the direct care workers, by $15,300, and the average per capita only went up by $15,200 during that time. That's not including the taxes that are involved with that, unemployment, work comp, or health insurance during that time. And so if I'm understanding that right, I wanted to make that point. The third point on this slide that I wanted to make is that in 25 years of forecasting in the state, and even probably longer, the numbers always come up short from where they're at. And so when we're looking at 27, 28, 29, and some of how those numbers are going, the delta between what's projected and what actually happens has always consistently been significantly higher. If you look at what 2022 actual spend was versus what it was projected beforehand, we're looking at a fractional difference in what we have there. And so while, yes, there is the trend there, I would suggest to members that the forecast has always been higher than what the actual spend ends up being, not always because of the good work that we're doing here, but because the forecasts are optimistic or pessimistic, depending on how you look at that. And the final point that I wanted to make on just this slide alone is that some of the per capita is going to be larger for this just naturally because of the effects of the global pandemic with long-term care facilities. We talked about it 2 years ago quite a bit in committee and on the floor about how you can't have the number of beds that you need in a facility because you can't get the staff, and so you put those beds on layaway, and then you can't afford to hire new staff to bring those beds back on, and so just naturally the number of people you're able to serve is going to be lower, while at the same time your rent is still going to be the same, the loan payments are still going to be the same. Some of those expenses stay the same whether you have staff there to fund that or not, and so that's part of the spiral, and I just wanted to offer that as context to these pieces here. And then finally, Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging me on some of these contextual points. The same thing with slides 16 through 19, I think it would be helpful when we look at those to also understand what the federal match is. I always compare Minnesota to what Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota are doing. And I know our Medicaid match for what we spend is at about, 51% or somewhere around there, versus Wisconsin, that's around 61%. Iowa, that's at around 60%. North Dakota and South Dakota match up with us on that reimbursement rate the matching rate a little bit better, but along with that, so how would those numbers and how would the federal matches that come into that play into the charts that we're looking at here, and does that even out when we're having to pay more to provide the same service that Wisconsin is paying because their per capita income is lower overall. And so, thank you. That's all I had there.
That's all. Well, thank you, Representative Schumacher. Any comments from the presenters regarding the representative's comments?
Yeah, I hope I can get to all of them, though. on the first point of comparing the per capita numbers on chart 13, I do agree with you that a lot of these are different, of course. Comparing families with basic care for families with children is definitely different from long-term care or services. But then again, the point that I'm emphasizing here is where the growth is coming from. So if we're going to look at somewhere, that is has to be where we look, is the long-term care waivers. That's where that is not, I don't think that is a truth that we can escape as the numbers show. The other thing, too, the second point was that a lot of the spending increases that we had in this period, I think you mentioned that we got good money for them because they enabled us to raise wages for long-term care workers. I think that's a good thing. Lower reimbursement rates for Medicaid have been a concern for a long time. But then again, we have to be cognizant of the fact that we have limits. We cannot, Minnesotans do not have infinite pools of money laying around for the state government to collect. So again, as we do all of these changes, we have to consider the costs that come with them. And again, this chart is just showing that this changes that we're doing, it's going to need more money from the state, and we have to find that money somewhere. And really the only way to maintain that would be high taxes, if that is something that we have to continue. But then, again, as the rest of the presentation has shown, that would also come with its own costs as well. Now, as for the comparison with states like Wisconsin, I just want to add that I think that the fact that we do spend more on Medicaid compared to all of these other low-income states should be a bigger reason for us to be even more careful about the growth of those programs, because, again, we're chipping more than some of these other states. So, again, now when you're thinking about what's happening with the federal government with the growing debt, there's a lot of serious talk right now about cutting those numbers even further. Again, that is another concern that we have to think about as well. So I hope I addressed everything. But
just if I could just throw something in there as kind of context, I suppose. I mentioned briefly when I was talking earlier about Balmol's cost disease, and I don't know how many people are familiar with that. Forgive you if you're not. But essentially it's the idea, and I think it's worth talking about in a little bit of length here. It's the idea that the wages in unproductive or less productive sectors tend to get dragged up by the wages in more productive sectors. And the reason for that is if you think of an economy with two sectors, so you've got, say, healthcare and manufacturing. So manufacturing workers, you can just throw capital at that, and workers can become a lot more productive, and that drives their wages up. You can't necessarily do that in a setting like education or healthcare. So if you think of education, for example, how can you make a teacher more productive in the same way that you can make an auto worker more productive? An auto worker can produce many more cars per day, but a teacher can't teach more children per day. Now, you can do things like, you can put, your lectures online, or you can cram more kids into a classroom, but both of those kind of dilute the quality of the product. So what I'm saying essentially is in those sectors, the labor is the product, whereas in manufacturing, the labor is an input into production, along with capital and things like that. What that means is that where you've got wages going up in, say, manufacturing, people get more productive, their wages go up, then why would anybody work in the other sector? Because they can just shift to the other one. And so the only way that you can keep people working in the less productive sector is to pay them more, and their wages kind of get dragged up by the wage increases in the other sector. And that's a real problem. And if you look at the demographics that we talked about in this report, you're going to have that situation more with things like long-term care, elderly care. This is a big problem that is being faced by governments across the Western world, national and state governments. And so to some extent, we are here to raise problems as much as solve them, I'm sad to say. You know, we can't keep on with this kind of magic money tree thinking. We do have to start thinking to ourselves, you know, there are hard choices ahead. And so, you know, what do we do?
Thank you for that. Before we go on to other questions, I want to give Representative Koznick the chance to introduce himself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative John Koznick from Lakeville, serving my sixth term. I know just about everybody at the table here, so happy to be here, and I appreciate your grace with my delayed attendance as I was able to visit my daughter in Kansas City. Unfortunately, the evening didn't turn out that great.
In Kansas City, no less. Well, I assume that you then have my sympathies given the halftime performance. We'll go on to other questions. Next, I have Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to slide 5. I guess I just have a question on that one. In 2425, that took into account all the one-time spending, right?
Yes, it did.
Did it assume that that one-time spending was ongoing then?
No.
Members and testifiers, I'm going to encourage you to work through the chair. It's just kind of the way we do things around here, and I hate to get off on a bad foot, so please address the chair before you answer questions and as you ask questions. Miss, and I'm going to mispronounce your name horribly, Martha.
yes, so thank you, Mr. Chair. So that budget baseline did not assume that spending would go on permanently. You've seen here in the 2026-27 biennium. But again, I did not assume that would be permanent. But as you can see from the 2026-27 biennium, there is still a significant increase in the permanent spending of the budget that is shown here by the 7.8 billion dollar increase in the baseline budget of the next biennium. Again, the point of this slide really was to show the significant changes that happened in that 2023 session and how much money was invested in the budget, short term or long term. So that's what that is.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you. Do you have, Mr. Chair, and do you have any, anything that shows the impact of that spending and how much more was brought in back into the state? I know specifically in transportation, we invested $200 million of matching federal money, and that brought in over $1.1 billion in federal money. So was there any slides on how that investment impacted Minnesotans?
Ms. Jolomolje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that is a little bit outside of the purview of this presentation. I would just like to say we are talking about the general fund budget here, about how much money we're spending in the state, which is really what matters for the purposes of this presentation. We're dealing with the state budget deficit. So we're only looking at how much we're collecting and spending in the state. I'm not sure counting the money that comes from the federal government would change any of this, but...
Yeah, yes. A point I would make there is that if you're saying we're spending $200 million and we get $1 billion off the feds, well, great, but you've still got to find the $200 million somewhere, you know, and that's the situation that you're in here.
Thank you, Mr.
One last question, Mr.
Just a second. Thank you, Mr. Phelan. And next time, address the chair first, please. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question. can you tell me what programs you have put into that welfare bucket? I'm kind of curious what your definition of welfare is.
And I'm going to try one more time. I'm trying to get it right. This is Jolomolje. Is that right?
Mr. Chair. Yes, it's in Jolomolje.
Jolomolje.
Yes.
Thank you.
So I assume you're talking about slide number 15. So the U.S. Census Bureau is the one that collects data from states on this. So they do put together a lot of really anything that is means tested. So that includes Medicaid, for example. That is really the biggest welfare program in under this definition of public welfare. But we also have the cash assistance program, so that would include the MFIP money. It would also include state-specific programs such as general assistance and Minnesota Supplemental Aid. It also includes child care assistance and some form of housing assistance. So really the majority, if not all of the, most of the DHS spending, that if we are talking about state-specific money, we'll be talking about DHS spending, at least before it was divided into the three categories that we have right now.
Thank you. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the sake of transparency, for anyone who may be listening to this presentation, because you are speaking with authority and you are the first group to come before this committee to speak about our state budget, I was looking at your 990, the latest one that's on file from November 2024. So I'm trying to figure out where the $4 million that you use for operations comes from. Could you maybe just give me a general overview of where the money of your organization comes from?
Mr. Phelan.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It's above my pay grade, unfortunately. What I would say is that this is really a presentation about the state budget, not our budget. And the second thing I'd say is that we are funded by people all over Minnesota. You know, our median donation is very, very low. And I gather that, you know, if you look at grassroots funding for certain political parties, we actually raise a lot more grassroots funding than them. So, yeah, all sorts of people all over the state is the best I can give you.
Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two more questions, please. So I just wanted to say that of the money that comes into your organization, you also fund other organizations such as Alpha News, Horwitz Freedom Center, Minnesota Parent Alliance, Minnesota Voter Alliance, PragerU, Take Charge, Turning Point USA, and Upper Midwest Law Center. Do you also please take information from those entities and work their storyboards into your presentation?
Mr. Phelan.
Well, we take information from all sorts of people. You know, if you look at this presentation here, we've taken information from Minnesota Management and Budget primarily, from the Minnesota Demographer's Office, from the Tax Foundation. Wherever there's good information, we'll use it. But again, I would make the point that this is a presentation about Minnesota's budget, not my organization's budget.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. Well, you know, I took statistics in college, and I know that you can use numbers in a variety of ways, so I will just say it that way. If you have a storyboard that you want to promote, you can use numbers. Almost anybody can take the exact same numbers and use them in different ways. Now, I would like to address the spending that you talk about with long-term care, Medicaid. I've just spent 6 years of my life working on aging in Minnesota. So making sure that we are caring for our elderly and making sure that persons living with disabilities also have a dignified way to live in our state. My question to you is this. The individuals are here. The individuals have multiple comorbidities. The individuals are mostly in Greater Minnesota. My question to you is, with the longer distances for services, the more expensive costs in housing, the higher the utility rates go, and we cannot leave out the role of private equity in these long-term care costs and the cost of pharmaceuticals in these long-term care costs. When you are looking at this growing need that we have, over 20% of our state population now is 65 or older, and that number is expected to grow, can you please tell me exactly what do you want for the quality of life for these individuals. Thank you.
I'm not sure who wants to address that. Mr. Phelan.
Yeah, I'll take that. So there's a couple of points there. The first is the argument that you can make numbers say anything you want. Of course, is the old line, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And there's some truth in that, but I often find that that is a line that's used by people who just don't like the numbers, and they want to dismiss numbers that they don't see. You know, the numbers that are uncomfortable, they just want to wave them away. So that's generally, I think, the experience there. In terms of the, you know, the quality of life for people and how this impacts people, I don't doubt that there are going to be impacts. And our point here is to say that you've got a problem and you need to get real about addressing it. And you can't just assume that this money is going to keep appearing from nowhere. And so that's why we have this forecast budget deficit now. That's why my colleague Martha has given you chapter and verse on how we've blown the lid off this thing and how it's going to keep consuming an ever larger state share of state spending and of Minnesotans' income going forwards.
Representative Claiborne, I'll allow you one more question.
Thank you very much. Also in this state budget forecast, you haven't said anything about the massive number of tax expenditures that are also in this state and the impact of those tax expenditures on our budget as well. Is that something that you plan to address as well?
Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I want to talk about something that was brought up with the November 2024 focus. I think there was about a $1 billion decline in the income tax revenues, and a little bit of that was due to the tax changes that happened in the 2023 sessions. But to that also, I would say, again, if there's any tax expenditures in the budget, in the budget that are leading to this deficit, that's also a direct result of policy changes that happened in that session. So those can be changed if you feel like that is something we have to address. Another thing too, if we look at the current budget, tax revenues are actually higher now than they were supposed to be in the 2023 February forecast. So revenues are still going up. So we do not really have a revenue problem. What we do have is that, and this is something that MMB notes in their budget, in their forecast, is that spending every year is growing up by more than tax revenues are going up. So that is really the issue that we have at hand.
Thank you. Thank you. Members, as I look at the clock and look at the number of members that have questions, I'm going to ask you to limit yourselves to one question and one follow-up so that we have some chance of finishing and still hearing from all of you who would like to ask a question. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to simplify the challenge that we have when we talk about the human services programs. It's complex. And if anybody is able to give us the right solution, they're welcome. let me put it this way. We're talking about people. We're not talking about programs and numbers.
Yeah.
And when we talk about the data that we have, more than 45% of the children in Minnesota, over 600,000 children, are impacted in Medicaid. And when it comes to the adults, over 29%, almost 990,000 or more Minnesotans who are adults are impacted by Medicaid. Over 28% of those individuals that we're talking about are individuals with disabilities. That's 180,000 individuals. When we talk about cutting Medicaid, we're talking about 17% of older adults in the state of Minnesota. That is over 170,000 individuals who are going to be impacted. And when we generalize the long-term care and we don't go specific to the programs, are we talking about CADI waiver? Are we talking about elderly waiver? Are we talking about BI waiver? Are we talking about the CAC waiver? It's serving individuals who really are vulnerable in the state of Minnesota. When we talk about the children, let's look at the numbers and the data in terms of regions. 50.5% of those children are in northwest Minnesota. 43.9% are in northeast Minnesota. 46.4% are in southwest Minnesota. 40.7% are in southeast Minnesota. 41.4% are in central Minnesota. 41.6% of those children that we're talking about are in metro area. It's a statewide issue. We've got a challenge that we need to address. But this presentation simplifies something that is more complex, that needs a nuance. We need to be looking into who is being impacted. I know Mr. Jolomore mentioned that we need to cap the income guidelines. Members, for an income of an individual who is receiving Medicaid, it's $1,669 a month. It's $20,000 annual income. That's the individual we're talking about, who is getting Medicaid in the state of Minnesota. Once you reach that threshold, you're gone. And if you apply for Minnesota Care, your income up to $30,000 is who is eligible to receive by paying even the premiums in our basic healthcare system. Do we cut the nursing homes? Do we cut the waiver programs that we're providing assisted living areas? Do we look into different areas, how this complexity of the work that we do? And I appreciate Chair Schumacher mentioning the federal medical assistance percentage. Minnesota is at 51%. Alabama, for an example, is over 70% federal funding. We pay more because of our GDP. We need to be looking into the complexity of the whole picture, not just presenting numbers which are not aggregated, and looking at the totality of the work that we do. Members, I'll keep it that as a comment rather than a question, because we need to be doing this work in the committee so that we can address those challenges with those experts who are on the field, the practitioners who see this challenge every single day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Representative Nora. I allowed you great latitude and an extensive comment. You're correct. This is a complicated area. We cannot address all those complications in this committee. You have served on other committees that are related to these details, and I'm sure you'll be discussing these details in great depth in those committees. This presentation is meant to give us an overall picture of state finances versus state resources, and we do have challenging issues to deal with. No one's denying that. We'll go on, please, to Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to the testifiers. One thing I'll note, I think that part of the concern about the presentation, at least that I have, and it may have been underlying Representative Cleaborn's point, is just that I don't see sources for the information in the slides. Typically, when there's economists and researchers and others presenting to us, there's some way to sort of look at what they're presenting so we can then trust the numbers, because we can look at the numbers. So I guess I might just ask Mr. Chair if the testifiers could provide, I suspect that they have that information, if they could provide the sources for the slides. It would just be a request that I'd make to start. And then I wanted to note the slide regarding the loss of population. This, I suppose, is slide 40, and it's connected to a quote on slide 30 about higher taxes purportedly driving residents out. I did want to make sure that the testifiers and that all members of the committee are aware of the latest information from the state demographer, that while there was a temporary net loss of population, I think for a year or two, we really are just, I think there's a start to be an article out today showing that we're just at the baseline we've been at for decades now, which is that we lose about as many people as we gain. Sadly, there's plenty of reasons to leave, I suppose weather being number one, and then there's plenty of reasons to come as well. So just kind of wanted to note that. And then my question actually relates to slide 42, which talks about the growth of real capita GDP for Minnesota compared to the U.S. And again, there's no citation, but I will trust that these numbers are accurate, and then would love to receive information confirming that. I guess I understood the point in the presentation being that to say, well, Minnesota's higher taxes are causing this alleged lack of growth in the past bunch of years. But I was looking, Minnesota had some of the highest taxes in the country in the 1990s, and it sure looks like we had some really high growth. So if I could just get a sense from, and that's been true for decades, right? We've been a higher tax, higher investment, higher growth, higher living standard state, really rivaled only by Massachusetts, which I notice in many of your charts is right next to one another. So if you could just comment on kind of not just the last few years, but I think the evidence over decades would kind of put the lie to conclusions about the last couple of years. But I'm sure Mr. Phelan and Ms. Njolamole would have comments on that. Thank you.
Ms. Njolamole?
I will field this one.
Thank you. Mr. Phelan?
Yeah, so that chart there, the net gain loss of population, that's Census Bureau data. And the Census Bureau data does, in fact, show us losing residents every year. So if you want me to send you a link to that, I can send you a link to that. Drop me an email, and I'm happy to do that. You know, we had a couple of years where there was a net inflow, but no, generally since the turn of the 21st century, actually we've lost residents every year. And so this is the kind of net per 100,000. This is the rate to make it comparable, so it's not like you're comparing California's massive loss of 800,000 with the net loss from another smaller state. This is try and quantify the impact of all that. This chart that you've asked about here, I'm glad you asked about where this comes from. This comes from a report I have coming out imminently, where I take Minnesota's per capita GDP growth, and I use a technique called growth accounting to break down the growth rate in per capita GDP into the components arising from changes in human capital, physical capital, and total factor productivity. And so that's where this comes from. The data underlying it comes from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. You can go and download this from their website. I'm happy to send you that if you would like. But yeah, so what this shows you, I mean, taxes aren't the only factor. So one of the reasons that you have declining per capita GDP, for example, if you think about where per capita GDP growth can come from. So if you think of human capital, in my method, which I use, it's based on that by Dietrich Vollrath, who's a professor in Texas, wrote a book called Fully Grown, which is very good, and I'd recommend it to everybody. He breaks down human capital into that arising from the number of people employed in a state, the number of hours they work, their average human capital arising from their education, and the average human capital arising from their experience. So if you look at all this, Minnesota actually has very high rates of employment, and that's absolutely true. So, in fact, do all Minnesota's neighbors, even though they have very different rates of taxation and things like that. And so there's something else there. I wrote a report at the back end of 2023 about social capital, and where I said that actually there's a relationship between the levels of social capital in the state and economic well-being. I'm happy to send you that as well. So there's other things besides state policy that drive some of these outcomes. If you look at migration, for example, I've no doubt that there are people who move hither and thither because of the weather and things like that. But when you look at when people say these are the factors that influence migration, and they talk about things like the weather, you can't control the weather. You know, I know certain politicians think they can, but you can't control the weather in Minnesota. You know, so you have to think about what are the factors that drive people to move that state policymakers do have control over. And that is where you look at things like taxation. So if you look at human capital again, like I say, Minnesota's already got quite high levels of employment. So you're not going to drive more human, more per capita GDP growth from that. The second one is hours worked. Now, I don't believe that the aim of policy should be to have people working more hours. I actually think that we should be looking to get people working less hours so they can spend more time doing things that they enjoy more working. If you look at the other components of human capital, we have very high levels of human capital per worker arising from education, and we have reasonably high levels of human capital per worker arising from experience. So again, if you look at human capital in Minnesota and a portion of GDP per capita growth that arises from that, there isn't really the scope to drive very much higher per capita GDP growth from increasing any of those, because they're kind of already tapped out. So you're looking at things like physical capital. That means you're on to the next one. If you look at physical capital, Minnesota hasn't done that well in recent years in terms of physical capital formation. And so you're looking at, particularly since 2014, it's another inflection year comes back again, and you see that our rate of physical capital growth has lagged out of the United States. Our ranking of the growth rate has dropped. So there's a problem there. You know, why is it that physical capital accumulation is happening at lower and lower rates in the state? That brings you to the third one, which is total factor productivity, TFP. That's kind of calculated as a residual of the other two. And we don't do too well on that, but then again, it's a residual. It basically captures things like entrepreneurship and innovation. So you can start to look at what Minnesota can do there, because our rate has kind of held constant, but our ranking has fallen. So yeah, that's in my upcoming report. I just got a version of that back from our publisher today, so I'm happy to send you that when that comes through.
I guess my brief follow-up.
Brief.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll just note that I think that maybe there's totally agreed on the importance of human capital. I think that there may be just a philosophical difference in terms of how much more of a payoff we get investing in people, and that what we were seeing in those high bars in Minnesota. I'll be interested to look at your report and compare to the states around us. My understanding is that we've been higher than the rest of the country, even higher than the rest of the region for decades, because we've invested in people. And of course, that is what taxes buy, right? Is making people be able to live thriving lives through the power of all of us working together through government. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the testifier. I look forward to some further conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Similarly, you get what you pay for, right? Minnesota is a high quality state, and what's missing from this presentation are some other numbers. Those include that Minnesota ranks 6th as a top state for business. It's the highest state in the Midwest. This is from 2024. Also in 2024, Minnesota ranks number 3 as the happiest state to live in. Again, Minnesota being the highest state in the Midwest. And in 2025, it is the second best state to retire in, Minnesota is. So we do have higher costs, but we also have a higher standard of living and a higher quality of life here. I also just wanted to piggyback on what Representative Noor said about the humans that are behind these numbers. I have a constituent, David. I had a great conversation with him in a coffee shop last week. He is also a journalist. He has a child that has Down syndrome and autism. And one of the articles he wrote recently said this: Medicaid, home, and community-based service waivers, programs designed to provide alternatives to placing Medicaid-eligible people in hospitals, nursing facilities, or intermediate care facilities. These programs allow people like my son, as a minor and eventually as an adult, to live at home or independently rather than being institutionalized. It saves the state money. A National Kaiser Family Foundation study found, for example, that HCBS users cost about $36,000 compared to institutionalization around $47,000. He also says, for disabled adults, direct service professionals make it possible for many to live in their own homes, work, move about the community, live full lives. It means parents can choose to stay home and care for their disabled kids, or that we can work and afford to hire aides to provide the support they need, but only if budgets keep up with the costs. Then finally, Mr. Chair, my question is probably for Ms. Adrians. I'm just curious for the forecasting that's being done at the state level, if they're taking into account the potential cuts from the Trump and congressional Republicans, in addition to the tariffs that are being proposed that I know economists have said will lead to stagflation. If you could let me know if the budgeting in the state takes that into account, that would be helpful.
Ms. Adrians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mueller. I am flattered that you think that I'm in that level of knowledge about the forecast, but my understanding is that when the February forecast comes out, there will be the opportunity for the economists and for MMB to take into account any changes that have occurred. They typically don't take into account potential changes, so they will focus on things that either have happened or are certain to happen.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Minnesota is really unique in a lot of ways, and that is absolutely true, especially when it comes to waste, fraud, and abuse. We are one of the few places in the nation that have had not one, but multiple massive fraud issues. I just was getting a text from Jay Coles from KSDP5 asking me if I've been talking to whistleblowers, and I have, so I'll answer him. But the new Fraud Prevention Committee, we have whistleblowers coming out of the woodwork. And there is a very, very large group of whistleblowers within DHS. So my question is, back on slide 15, if you want to go back to that one, because we are so unique, because we've had Feeding Our Futures, we've had CCAP fraud, we've had Medicaid fraud, there's more to come. The whistleblowers will be telling a story. I'm not going to tell their story just here and now, but there is much, much more fraud to be uncovered. So I'm wondering, these slides and the slides after these, do you have any way to kind of quantify the cost of doing service, which includes administrative costs, waste, fraud, and abuse, compared to like what service actually gets to the person. Because I have a feeling, I don't have evidence, but I think in Minnesota, we don't do a great job at actually delivering because there's so many things in the way. The administrative costs, the overhead, the waste, fraud, and abuse. Fraud is absolutely rampant, and it's much, much more than has been calculated. I think, in fact, your group has a fraud tracker. It's a $610 million, and that's just what's you can, look it up in news stories and on and on and on in charges that have been filed and all of that. So I'm just wondering, are you able to quantify it all, compare it us to anybody else in the cost of delivery of these services? Because obviously the overall cost is quite high. Like I'm 15, you've got $40,000 to deliver service. But how much actually gets to the person that needs the service?
Mr. Phelan.
It's a difficult one, that, because by its nature, fraud is kind of hard to quantify. And it's certainly the case that the amount of fraud you've identified is less than the amount of fraud that actually goes on. What the actual number is, I don't know. In terms of how we compare in when it comes to fraud to other states, again, that's difficult because you run into the same problems of quantification. But I would say that Andy Luger, who the former U.S. attorney for Minnesota, said that Minnesota has a fraud problem and you don't see these problems in other states. Just a couple of points. So when you talk about delivery, and I think this kind of goes back to the points made just now, that Minnesota is a high tax, high spending, high delivery state. But of course, I would go back to the population numbers and say that if we were such a high delivery state, why do we lose residents every year? Why is South Dakota gaining residents every year? Why are states like Florida and Texas gaining residents every year? Florida is the number one destination for Minnesotans leaving the state. And they're not going there because the state government is spending a ton of money on them. So you have to think about things like that. And also these things where they measure rankings, the ranking of the happiest state. I mean, I'd be curious to know what other states ranked highly on that, because the reason I wrote my report on social capital is that you find that there are so many rankings of states where Minnesota is high, but so are all its neighbors. So there's something about this area, I don't know what it is, that makes Minnesota kind of show up among these rankings with all its neighbors. So I'd be very surprised if you look at the ranking of happiest states and that the Dakotas, Wisconsin, and Iowa aren't up there as well. And just to make a quick point before I finish, the thing about the CNBC state business tax or state business friendliness rankings, they are absolutely bogus. And they do not count the factors that make states business friendly. What they count is a lot of things like abortion access, which are just kind of measures of how liberal a state is. And then they say, oh, this, by the way, is what makes a state business friendly. I actually did a regression where I looked at the rankings of the state business friendliness that CNBC did and various measures of what businesses actually do. And I found, bizarrely, that the more business friendly a state became on CNBC's rankings, the less business activity there was in terms of business formation and capital investment and things like that. So I wouldn't waste any time with a ranking like that. Just focus on the data.
A follow-up, Representative Barrett.
No, I think he stated it well, Mr. Chair. I think we have a huge issue, like I said, of fraud and delivery of services.
Thank you.
I would really like to look at that at some point. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have more of comments. My questions on the charts can be done offline, especially with Ms. Adrian's, because the charts aren't really set up the way we usually look at them, and I have some questions. But I just wanted to mention I really appreciate what Representative Eric said about waste, fraud, and abuse. Just as a reminder, Feeding Our Futures happened during a confluence of events between federal money coming in and COVID. And as we talk about in local government, when we talk about a 100-year flood or a 200-year flood, because they're very rare. But just because they're rare doesn't excuse what happened. So I'm very happy that the trials are happening. And as a reminder, the last two years we put money into the Department of Education to do an Office of Inspector General. They have over 35 cases open right now. And they are doing the work that needs to be done. So I hope that does come up in the Committee of Waste, Fraud, and Abuse. And then also just a comment, too, about education. I appreciated that Mr. Phelan talked about the need to be productive in our economy. I take a little offense, because words matter, that the inference was that teachers are less productive or unproductive. And also saying that, you know, they can't teach more kids. Unfortunately, because of disinvestment, our class sizes are horrible right now. On average, it's 25 per elementary school and at least 30 to 35 per higher ed. So that's what happens with underfunding. And since we do have the requirement in our state constitution to provide a public form of education so that we do have an economy that grows, I think it's very important to think of that when we talk about the 880,000 students we have in our state. So just some comments there. Thank you.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to respond to a couple of comments that related to numbers. And nobody loves a good logical fallacy more than I do, being a longtime competitive debater. And the appeal is, the logical fallacy is an appeal to pity. And the notion of saying this is about people is true, and that this is going to cause an impact for people, that is true. And the looming $5.1 billion deficit was created by an approach of not looking at restraint, not looking at how to make sure that this is long-term viable. So don't try to create traction for your point of view by throwing out a logical fallacy saying, well, it's about the children, or saying it's about the seniors. You had the opportunity to consider that when you wrote these different budgets, and you blew through an $18 billion surplus, and then you came up with another $10 billion in taxes. And now, when that bill is coming due, and we're going to have to figure out how do we get out of this, then you raise your hand and say, well, it's about the children, it's about the people, it's about the insert thing here. Using a logical fallacy to make a point in a committee where we have to deal with dollars and cents is a really poor form of argumentation. And it's also assuming that the people on this side of the table don't care about those things, when in reality we do. We just now have to fix the problem that we've been given that has arisen over the last 6 years of spending. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, first of all, you know, you don't serve on taxes, but Mr. Chair, but Mr. Phelan, Ms. Njolamole have both been in front of the tax committee a number of times, and also appear in front of other committees. So the idea that their perspective is boxed out of the legislature is really just untrue. You know, when we certainly take testimony from all kinds of people. It's unfortunate that we weren't able to have sort of a discussion about this as the presentation was going along, because, you know, it's sort of like on every page or every other page, you have an example of why it is that it would be a much more productive exercise for us as a group of people who are going into this process of passing a budget together to have some, you know, nonpartisan information that was presented by, you know, our fiscal staff or the state demographer or the state economist or any number of other parties. You know, just like to take one example, right? The second page. General fund spending, general fund spending per capita. Well, we literally have an entire report called The Price of Government that tracks spending per capita as a percentage of GDP, which is like the actual way to track it over time. And what you will see, if you look at the Price of Government study, which you should all look at, is that over time, as a percentage of GDP, our investment in the public good, our government spending has been going down and down and down. And particularly, you know, on something like education, it's like in 2000, we've never gotten back to the level to restore the Pawlenty cuts of 2002. It's the same in local government aid. It's the same in county program aid. Last year, we got back to the 2002 numbers. And what's happened to the cost of everything since then? So it's all well and good for us to sit up here and say, oh, we don't believe in raising taxes. Well, what about our local government partners who have to keep the lights on, have to keep the roads paved, have to keep the schools open. They don't have the choice to do that. So what have we seen? We've seen over and over that as the state investment, as a percentage of GDP per capita, the price of government has gone down, those costs get passed on. They get passed on in the form of property tax levies mostly. And also, you know, these increases in sales taxes that we're seeing local governments wanting to implement. So anyway, I mean, you know, and we could go down the whole thing. It's like, you know, there are economists from all kinds of perspectives that believe in all kinds of things. I could come up with 7 quotes from economists that thought that taxes were good for the economy, just like you did in here with stuff that says taxes are terrible for the economy. There is, as you well know, a lot of conversation in academia, among people who analyze and think about this, about flight and about tax flight. There are smart, principled people who disagree on this, which is why we should be having a conversation that's actually a nonpartisan conversation to level set in this space right now. On taxes in particular, well, I guess first of all, it's like what I heard was a lot of like, there's a lot of doom and gloom coming from you guys, man. A lot of Minnesota carnage, a real, real dark vision of where we are. I mean, the truth is that, like, this is a good state. This is a good place to live. We have a very diverse economy in Minnesota. We have a lot going for us. And all we ever hear from this group is just like how awful everything is and how, like, you know, the corporate franchise rate being second highest in the country is like gonna doom us. And it's like, there are things that are important to people and things that influence people's decisions about where to live and how to live. And the corporate franchise rate's probably not among them. It's more like, how are the schools? How's the environment? How's the infrastructure? Like, are we meeting our, How is it to be an elder or somebody with a kid with disabilities and try to access public services? Those are the questions that really matter to people. And so, you know, in this conversation where we put economic indicators, we sort of like, you know, skew the data a little bit to reflect our fundamental belief about the world, which we could all do. And we say, oh, like, you know, Minnesota is this terrible high tax place. People are leaving. It's like we're omitting a big part of the story. And we've talked about it here. What do taxes buy? Like, taxes aren't just like a number on a page. They buy things for people. Mostly in our state, education and services for seniors and people with disabilities. And I absolutely agree. And I think we all agree, right? That you can see that mismatch. I mean, that's for real. Like, we have to deal with that. We have to be serious and take seriously the financial challenges that are facing us. But, you know, if we like ignore the fact that, you know, that we do have all of these benefits as a state and that we can like use what we have and move forward together to try to address the issues. Like, if we just ignore that and say, like, you know, Minnesota's a terrible place and you guys have ruined it and everybody's leaving, it's just not borne out in the data. It's just not borne out in the data. I mean, we talked about the increase in tax revenues. They are higher than expected. What does that mean? That means that people are doing okay here. It means that corporations are making a lot more money than we expected them to make, for example, for those who are always talking about the business climate. You did talk about the decline in revenues in 2023, and that's called a tax cut. That's because we delivered the biggest tax cut in Minnesota history in 2023. We invested in people. And so, I appreciate this conversation, but I hope that we can move forward in sort of a less ideological way in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. You're next, and I encourage you to leave time for the chair.
Well, thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will endeavor to do that. And, Mr. Chair, that was, I think, an interesting presentation from the Center for the American Experiment, and I mean interesting in the most Minnesotan way possible. I think my colleagues have done a pretty good job of pointing out many of the holes. I was amused when Mr. Phelan referenced the old saying that there are 3 types of lies, damn lies, and statistics. Because that was kind of going to be my headline for what we were looking at here. And then he dismissed it, saying that's usually just the carp of somebody who's just unhappy with what the numbers say. And then a few minutes later said that the study done by CNBC was bogus and really was just a measure of liberalism, which is amusing to me because I think it would come as a great shock to the people of Florida that they are a measure, a liberal, more liberal state than Minnesota, considering they ranked fifth right ahead of us. But in any event, there was a lot left out, and I think Representative Gomez, Representative Moeller, others illustrated that very well. But I did want to take a moment to talk about what I think is the elephant in the room, if you'll pardon the pun, which is the massive train that's headed towards us in terms of disastrous federal budget policy. You know, this presentation, the testifier said several times, was narrowly focused on the general fund budget, you know, which the base budget is about $67 billion for the next biennium. By comparison, the amount of federal funds Minnesota receives is about $46 billion, and more than half of that is Medicaid. In the paper this morning, said that congressional Republicans are eyeing as much as $2.5 trillion in budget cuts this year, most of which will be steep cuts to Medicaid. You can imagine what that will do to Minnesota's budget. And that's to say nothing of other domestic cuts. We get about $2 billion a month from the federal government, which out of nowhere, OMB tried to freeze for 24 hours before mercifully two federal judges blocked it. That will be disastrous. What will also be disastrous is the Trump administration's tariffs, which will increase inflation and decrease our gross domestic product. And you don't have to ask me that. That's what the Tax Foundation, a conservative-leaning tax analyst group, will tell you. It will be particularly disastrous for our energy production. Representative Akam noted to me the amount of energy that Xcel purchases from Canada, as well as Minnesota Power purchases from Canada. Also, most of our petroleum comes from Canada. If, in fact, there's a 25% Canadian tariff, that will increase gas prices to the tune of 50 cents a gallon. And all of that is going to have a significant impact on our state's budget. The last thing that I did want to mention, there was some conversations about the workforce today and some really interesting things. I would note that the Star Tribune actually had an article today about migration trends that substantially kind of contradicts the story that we heard from the testifiers today. The most recent numbers from 2024 did show a net domestic migration loss, but only about 1,000 people left Minnesota. Contrast that with natural growth of 12,000 and international migration of 30,000. Now, I think we can all agree that Minnesota has workforce challenges, and it's a big conversation that I'm sure Chair Baker and Representative Pinto are going to have in their committee, because we do have workforce problems. I tell you what will make them worse is dramatic decreases to our immigration, when most of our population growth in this state has come from international immigration for a long time. That's not a way to solve our workforce problems. It will make Minnesota's economy worse, and it will make our budget position worse. Somebody, I can't remember who, asked Ms. Adrians about the whether the November forecast or the February forecast would account for Trump administration policies, and the answer was maybe, right? Maybe some things, maybe not other things. What we do know is that the November forecast did not account for those things. I will make this prediction to you that the February forecast is going to show higher inflation, lower growth, and a worse budget position than the November forecast, and it will be entirely due to the Trump administration.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. You've gone over time. I do like to end committee on time, and we're not successful at that today because of unlimited remarks. I would ask your cooperation in the future and sticking to a reasonable time schedule. We all have our axes to grind, and you've done a nice job of grinding today. I would encourage members not to disparage the presenters. That's not really acceptable. If you have questions about their resources, that's fine, but questioning their motives by questioning their resources is not appropriate. Finally, did you have something to say?
I did not impugn motives.
I would like to thank the presenters. Thank you for coming in today, and we do appreciate the information you brought forward. It's been stimulating. Obviously, we hit some sore spots on the other side of the aisle, and that's just fine by me. Ms. Drolamole and Mr. Phelan, I do appreciate your presentations, and thank you for being with us today. You know, we have a severe financial problem ahead of us. I think that's, we all agree on that. And we have some tough decisions to make. I think we all agree on that. How we answer these questions is the challenge before us. And I would hope that as we go forward, we actually identify things that we can make improvements on. I'm just going to point out one small thing. I had a representative come to me last week who had been to his HHS director in his local county, and he observed the computer system that those folks are working on, and he said, you know, I think I played Pong on that computer system 25 years ago. You Democrats had the opportunity to invest in those systems, and you failed to do it. The efficiency of our government is dependent on being efficient and having systems that actually work. This problem didn't just occur this year. It's been around for a long time, and recognizing these issues is something we all need to do. Efficiency in government is critical to serving people well. With that, today, we are adjourned.